Hey there, listeners. I just wanted to let you know that the music post is finally up and available on the iTunes Store and should be coming to Stitcher Radio very soon if it's not already up there as well. If you're listening from one of these sources, obviously you're aware of this, but if not, you can now subscribe from one of them and have the episodes automatically delivered to your phone or tablet through whatever app you choose. And you can always, of course, listen through the website if you choose. And I'll always post links there relevant to each episode, including this week, the link to the music post in the iTunes Store. That website, again, is www.samueljpost.com/podcast. In addition, if you enjoy the music post, since it's just getting started, please take the time to rate it in the iTunes Store. This can be a huge help in referring other listeners who, like you, will enjoy it as well. Okay, here's today's episode. Sam Post, and welcome to the Music Post. Each episode, of course, we delve into a new piece of music, listening to it, learning about it, and figuring out what makes it work. Okay, so I promise we will get to something other than The Art of Fugue by Bach, but today we march onward with probably the most popular of all the fugues from it, Contrapuntus 9. It's the most upbeat of the lot, at least the way most people play it, and so it has this visceral excitement, this sense of virtuosity, that makes it maybe a bit more approachable, a bit more immediately likable than some of the other fugues from the Art of Fugue. Of course, they're all incredibly likable, it's just, I guess, people sometimes have a little bit of a harder time getting into slow pieces, I don't know. We haven't covered all of 1 through 8, that precede number 9 in the podcast, but I hope you've gotten some idea for how the main theme that we heard back in Contrapuntus 1 has been twisted around in the intervening fugues. Once again, here is that main theme. In episode 2, we heard it upside down. We also heard it syncopated with notes filling in the gaps. In episode 3, we heard it right side up, upside down, with these French-style dotted rhythms. We heard a fast version and a slow version. I'm not going to play them all for you right now. Go back and listen if you missed it. Highly recommend that episode. Now, at the beginning of Contrapuntus 9, you won't hear the main theme at all, which might seem a bit strange because all of these pieces have started with some version of the main theme. But it comes back later in the fugue in its original form in really stunning fashion. And if you miss this the first time you hear it in a moment on the piano, have no fear. I assure you, you won't miss it when you hear it on this massive church organ at the end of the show. And it's a really powerful moment on the organ, so get ready. Before that, I'll tell you about some of the pros and cons of playing this piece, as well as some of the others from the Art of Fugue on the piano versus the organ. And I'll show you how this fugue really holds some of the secrets to Bach's music more generally, how it illustrates quite well what makes Bach's music so great. That's quite a lot to look forward to there, so I hope you'll stay with me. Here it is, first on piano, Contrapuntus 9 from The Art of Fugue. Thank you. That begins to give you a sense of how thrilling and divine this music is, even with the admittedly imperfect human playing. The first really striking thing about this piece is the way it combines these incessant, quick-moving notes, which come from the first theme you heard at the beginning, here, how it combines them with these long, sustained, soaring melodies, which you may have recognized as the main theme from The Art of Fugue, from Contrapuntus 1. Only it's even slower than that. So, for instance, about a quarter of the way through the fugue, we hear them together for the first time this way. So, with the other voices added, here's how it sounded. Now, by virtue of having these two main themes that come back again and again together throughout this fugue, it's called the double fugue. And I have to say, moments like these that I just played for you, I find them a little bit underwhelming on the piano, and the reason is this long, sustained melody doesn't work so well because on the piano, as soon as you play a note, it immediately begins to decay. So while this melody is going on, we can't hear it quite so clearly because the fast-moving notes are interfering with it. And that's not the case on, for instance, the organ. And it really makes for a more powerful effect, at least in this specific aspect. So let me just play you that same passage now from a church organ recording I made, and you'll hear the difference. This long melody really cuts through so clearly, and it's amazing. How awesome is that? And it gives me goosebumps every time I come to that part of this piece. That moment, in a way, was what made me fall in love with The Art of Fugue. I heard this Contrapuntus 9 for the first time not that long ago, actually, on the radio, and I must have turned it on really close to the beginning, but I didn't know what the piece was, and suddenly I heard the main theme, which I knew from having heard Contrapuntus 1 in the past, emerge out of nowhere, and it was an unforgettable moment for me. So if there's one moment that you remember or look forward to in listening to The Art of Fugue, you could do a lot worse than this one. Okay, so let's look a little more closely now at the first main theme, what I call the quick-moving subject. It has five basic elements. It starts with this octave leap, then a scale down, then we get these successive groups of four rising notes, and they're actually grouped also into two groups of eight. Next, we have this little sighing gesture, sometimes without a trill. And now we get a falling gesture to complement the rising gesture we heard earlier. Again, two groups of eight notes. Repeat. And that's our first subject. And the reason I've gone into such detail explaining it is because each of these elements comes back individually, and especially the falling gesture toward the end is pretty much omnipresent throughout the rest of this fugue. Now, this is pretty standard for Bach, taking short musical phrases, short ideas, recycling them, and for this reason, his music is often called imitative. People say it uses imitation. Now, sometimes you read about Bach or you take a class on classical music more generally, and you get the impression that imitation is enough, that if you relate different parts of a piece together, that's all it takes to make good music. That's very clearly not the case. If you use imitation very straightforwardly, what you get is music that's in fact very boring, because it's very repetitive. And a lot of the music around the time of Bach proves this. My favorite target is Telemann, but he's definitely not the only one. There are these composers who wrote music that's superficially similar to Bach's, but really subpar by comparison. Because there's clearly this trade-off between reusing the same musical materials over and over and throwing in variety. On the one hand, if you use too much imitation, very boring. If there's not enough imitation, if things don't relate together, then the music doesn't have enough coherence. And Bach strikes this balance especially well. His music is very repetitive, organized on one level, but on another level, it's constantly breaking these patterns, constantly finding different variations to this organization in ways that's very unpredictable and very clever and always defying our expectations. So the key here is this balance between recycling ideas, repetition on the one hand, and variation, finding differences and breaking the patterns on the other hand. Certainly not a complete explanation of what makes this music great, but I think it's a start, and it's better than some explanations that try to make it even simpler than that. I feel like these explanations are destined to fail because this music just isn't simple. There's no way around it. Okay, so let me show you a little bit what I mean with this, what you might call unpredictable repetition or recycling. Recall this falling gesture from the quick-moving theme at the beginning, which gets repeated twice. Now, after all four voices have stated their first entrance of this quick-moving theme at the beginning, we get the different voices trading back and forth this falling gesture, only it's a little different in that, first of all, they're rising with each iteration of this gesture instead of falling, and the alto statement gets changed a little bit unexpectedly. Very subtle, but I think important as well. So first we hear it here in the soprano. Higher. Now in the bass here. Higher. Now in the alto. Different that time. A bit later, we hear the main art of fugue theme in the tenor voice down here with the quick moving subject in the alto, and it's a really lovely moment. It's the first time we've gone to a major key in this piece. And listen also to the soprano line, which isn't playing either of the main themes, but again is echoing elements from that quick moving theme, first with the falling gesture, now the sigh. Gesture along with the alto voice. So you never know when or how Bach is going to throw in something you've heard, something you recognize, in a new combination, a new variation, maybe with a little difference. And he does it in such a way that makes it difficult to wrap your mind around it completely in the moment, but it's still registering unconsciously as something you know. In a few spots in this piece, we get these short sections or cells of music that are repeated up or down a step in what's called a sequence. Here's one of them, and listen to how in this sequence we get repeated statements of the falling gesture from the quick-moving theme, traded back and forth between the alto and soprano voice. So you'll hear it first here in the alto, and then the soprano, and then back to the alto. Repeat lower. I fooled you. That's not what Bach writes in this case. That's what Telemann would have written, repeating this same cell three times in a row going down. Instead, Bach breaks the sequence in the middle of one of the sequential cells unexpectedly. Start the next cell of the sequence. Break. Now another sequence later on. This one uses the rising notes from the original quick moving theme here. Instead of the falling ones, as the last sequence did. Again, I'm going to play you the way it could have been written first. That was the Telemann version. Here's the Bach version. And in breaking this sequence prematurely, he changes from the rising figure to the falling one. He throws in what we call these false entrances of the main Art of Fugue theme, where we get just the first two notes, and then it breaks. And he quickens the pace of the harmonic changes in the bass. All of these contribute to the rising tension in this passage, which works much better than what you just heard. Such a better way to drive this section of music forward. Much more dramatic, much more urgency. One more example now, this time not a sequence, but rather another example where we have these two main themes being played together. The main Art of Fugue theme in the tenor here, and the quick moving theme from this fugue in the alto. And the other statements of these main themes have set up a certain expectation for how they conclude. But this time that pattern breaks in a wonderful and unexpected way. One more time, I'm going to play a simplified version of what we're expecting, and then the Bach version. And now the real one. Surprise! And notice how it didn't change the contours of either of these main themes, but rather just these little chromatic intervals instead. So instead of, we got, and in the other one instead of, we got, but those small changes, together with the changes in the other two voices, made for a very striking difference in character. It turns out in this case, this change is very fleeting, which is another thing that's quite characteristic of Bach, especially in the Art of Fugue. We transitioned from this very dissonant, crunchy, chromatic section onto this major chord, but very quickly we're moving away back to minor without getting this sense of feeling grounded or settled at all. Let me play you again what happens getting into that moment and then continuing on. Here we are. But again, very dark. So it was a passing moment that we just had this chance to enjoy before we get pulled away. Whew. Okay. We've learned a lot about this piece and about Bach, and I want to encourage you now to step back and forget for a little while everything I've told you and just listen. Remember that I'm not an organ player, so in many ways what you're about to hear might not be as polished as what you heard earlier on the piano, but there's something so awesome and compelling about hearing this piece on the organ, even without some of the details and the same clarity that we get on the piano. So maybe dim the lights, crank up your volume if you have speakers, and let this music wash over you. Here we go then. Contrapuntis 9 on the organ. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed that. That's our show for today. You can find out more about the music post, as well as other relevant links, at www.samueljpost.com/podcast. You can let me know what you think, leaving a comment there, or by emailing me at samueljpost@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join me next time on the Music Post.